Hi, this is Steve. Whenever I'm out of the office for a bit, I always check in to ask, are there any messages for me? Summer takes us out of the routine, and I know this means you might miss a Sunday at South Main from time to time. When you do miss, I hope you'll check in right here and ask, are there any messages for me? Because the answer is yes. Yes, there are. This summer at South Main, we've been exploring the compelling life of the disciple Peter each Sunday, and his life experiences. His seismic and captivating experiences are full of fascinating messages for us. Listen, here's this week's.
Max Tegmark is a physics professor at MIT who's written a book called Our Mathematical Universe, and in it he explores the strange world of quantum mechanics and what the true nature of reality is really like. And the book takes up ideas from the very, very big, the possibility that our universe is only one of an infinite number of parallel universes, scientists called the multiverse, to the very, very small, the notion that electrons and other subatomic particles can exist simultaneously in two places at once. And the reason the world of quantum mechanics seems so bizarre and so counterintuitive to us is that the very, very big and the very, very small just aren't domains our intuitions have been attuned to by evolution. To put it in a way that I could understand, Tegmark writes, natural selection rewarded with survival, not our caveman ancestor who pondered what was beyond the stars and missed the saber-toothed tiger sneaking up from behind him, but rather the one who contended well and contended best with the world at his or her own scale. And that's all to say that to understand quantum mechanics, we need to be prepared to be wrong a lot. In fact, Tegmark goes so far to say that if a developing quantum theory isn't counterintuitive to us, we ought to be suspicious of it. And what I'd like to do today, what I'd like to posit today, is that this is true not only in quantum physics, but it's true in our faith as well. God's ways are so different than ours. Christ's teachings are so different than our instincts. Grace and love so different than karma and cause and effect. The idea of forgiveness so counterintuitive to our desire to strike back. That if we earnestly want to push the envelope in understanding God and grace and love, that those revolutionary ideas, and a Messiah king that's willing to be crucified as a criminal on a Roman cross, we probably ought to be prepared to be wrong a good deal of the time as well. Which brings us to Peter, whose life we've been exploring so far this summer. We're about 4 or 5 weeks in, and it appears, doesn't it, that Peter's main characteristics seem to be, one, he's very devoted to Jesus. And two, he seems to be wrong a lot about Jesus. And today I want to explore if maybe there's a correlation between these two characteristics. Our text is Luke chapter 9, verses 28 through 35, as you'll recall Hank read just a moment ago. And Jesus has taken Peter and James and John up onto a mountain to pray. And we're told something very unusual is happening. The appearance of Jesus' face begins to change. His clothes become white like lightning. And then if that weren't enough, suddenly Old Testament characters start to appear. Moses and Elijah show up and they speak to Jesus. And Peter, just awakening, not realizing what he was saying, says to Jesus here in the middle of verse 33, Master, it's an excellent thing. It's a good thing for us to be here. I propose we make 3 booths, 3 tents, 3 shelters constructed of leafy branches of trees, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. But just then there comes a cloud and it begins to surround and envelop them, and they become afraid, and then a voice comes from the cloud saying, "This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him." And at the coming of the voice, Jesus was found alone. Again, this is the word of the Lord. Only a few years out of law school, I was asked to represent the Texas Department of Public Safety in a lawsuit. A truck was traveling on a curving, hilly stretch of 59 South outside of Lufkin, Texas, in rainy conditions when its driver lost control of his truck and it careened across a grassy esplanade, colliding with a car traveling north. And in the lawsuit that followed, the car driver's family was represented by a legendary Texas trial lawyer. He had represented the Apollo 1 astronauts' families and the Challenger astronauts' family. His name was Ronnie Crist. And the trucker and his employer were represented by a really great, outstanding defense lawyer in Houston named Jeff Murphy. And we were all about a month out from trial, and we were preparing to take the deposition of Mission's main liability expert. He was an engineer, and I knew he was going to blame my client, the DPS, alleging that the roadway was, its maintenance was poor, and its design was poor and flawed in terms of its curve and its pitch. But before I could ask any questions, Mr. Crist, who for financial reasons had targeted Mission and not my client, the DPS, turned to me and said, "Son, I've got this." And he proceeded to just dismantle the expert with the most blistering and withering cross-examination that I had ever seen. And when he was finally done, anticlimactically, it's my turn to ask questions. And I'm not sure if Jeff, Mission's lawyer, was more irritated at Mr. Crist, who is now gloating at him from across the table, or that I was asking similar questions that had already been asked. But Jeff finally asked the court reporter to go off the record. And he leaned over the table, and he pointed to Mr. Crist, and he said to me, "You think you can do it better than him? How much more do you have left?" And I turned a few pages back and forth on my yellow legal pad as if I was about to wrap up anyway. And I asked a few more questions just to save face, and then I passed the witness. But the truth was, he was right. I spoke when I didn't need to. And I went to school on this, and I began to learn that if a judge is already leaning your way, just keep quiet. If another lawyer elicits what you need from a witness, there's no need to ask any more questions. And often in life, I think we take saying nothing off the table too quick. There's a lot to be said for silence, for quiet, for stillness. And it's a lesson Peter should have thought about there on the mountain. Instead, he's like a human gumball machine. Something momentous has happened, and it's like somebody dropped a quarter into the top of his head, and a gumball descends, and he feels like he has to say something. And he's so wrong-headed. And he's so missing the point that God has to show up via cumulus cloud to correct him. Even Luke says he didn't know what he was saying. And it's an amazing turn of events. But before we look at the events a little bit more closely, a little bit more deeply, let's pause here to ask a more primary question, a more primal question. And that's this. What kind of story is this? Is it a miracle? Is it a vision? Is it a metaphor made super vivid by the author so that we don't miss the point? Some of us may say, "Hey, you just told us about parallel universes and electrons that could be at more than one place at once. God is not obliged to follow the rules. God makes the rules. This is a miracle." And then others, though, among us may point out that this was written a full generation after the events that it purports to relate, and legends grow, And a good author often takes poetic license to drive home his or her most crucial themes. So what do we do with this? What are we supposed to believe? What do you believe? Well, do you have 20/20 vision? I don't. Many of us have distorted vision. The lenses in our eyes are imperfect, so we need to get contacts. We need to get glasses. But really, the prescriptions we get are no more than just another distortion. It's just that the original distortion, when combined with the second distortion, creates a double distortion that then produces the clearest picture of what's right in front of us. And I think that's also the case that some of our clearest thinking, our least distorted pictures of reality, arise when we use two lenses at once. First, we drop down a clear-eyed reason, a modern lens full of rigor and rationality. And then next, we drop down a second lens, one that's open to wonder, that's open to the transcendent, open to the miraculous and the mysterious. And although the real truth must be one or the other, when we're willing to use both lenses simultaneously or fluidly camp and decamp between the possibility of miracle and the likelihood of metaphor or vice versa, that double distortion combines to yield not incoherence, but instead a more resonant sense of truth, a more resonant picture of the truth. You know, the Bible is full of art. It's full of allegory, poetry, theater, parable, legend, which all reveal honest truth. However, at the same time, we shouldn't rush always to insist every miracle is just a story, just a metaphor. We shouldn't be out to quell wonder and beauty or be so quick to debunk the miraculous. We shouldn't be like the guy that runs into the theater screening a sublime movie and ask, why all the tears? It's just photons on a wall. You don't have to insist on demystifying everything, but embrace the tension of the two lenses, the double distortion. Be willing to explore an ongoing dialogue between your left brain and your right brain, between the rational and the transcendent, the historic and the metaphysical, between artistry and biography, because it's often there that you'll find God magnetized to the truth just waiting for you. You can take a long position on reason or a short position on miracle or vice versa. You're Baptist after all. But either way, be assured there's beauty and meaning and wisdom housed in Scripture, embedded in these ancient stories, and their sometimes elusive truths are revealed only by holding two lenses up at the same time to open eyes, to open hearts in an abiding stillness. A stillness which brings us back to Simon Peter. He's just not a man of stillness, is he? He's a man of action. And while we love this about him, this momentous event, this mountaintop experience, whatever it was, should clearly have reduced him to silence, to stillness. But instead, he's proposing building tents, building shelters. But really, what I think he's saying to Jesus is two things. First, he's saying, I see you, Jesus, on par with the two very pillars of the Hebrew faith, Moses the lawgiver and Elijah the prophet. And second, because of that, Jesus, we ought to stay here, up here on the mountaintop where it's excellent and safe, not to go to Jerusalem where harm certainly awaits. But then even as he speaks, God thunders down, no, it's neither the law nor the prophets that expresses most deeply who I am, God says, but the self-sacrificial love and redeeming grace embodied in Jesus, my son. It's in his teachings and all that you'll soon see unfolding in Jerusalem that the invisible God will be made visible for all. And whether it's metaphor or miracle, that's the message of the two lenses here, and it's exactly what Peter's so wrong about, which begs the question, how after 3 years of sermons and healings, adventures and conversation, can Peter not know this? How can Christ's closest confidant and his most earnest and devoted disciple be wrong, not just about this, but about so much and so often? Well, I think the answer to this question is the very core lesson of Peter's life. It teaches us this. An earnest and devoted faith in God tends to vigorously instruct us more on what we're wrong about than what we're right about. What God is showing us with Peter's life and his mistakes and his errors is that if we're as devoted to Christ as Peter, what we're likely to discover is that we, like him, aren't thinking nearly expansively enough, nearly imaginatively enough about the power of grace, the import of love in the realm of the invisible. Peter's life tells us that if our religion seems always to be confirming what we think we're right about more than it's teaching us what we're wrong about, we should be suspicious that we're not truly and actively seeking out God as ardently as we might think we are. And that's all to say that if we're as dedicated as Jesus as Peter, we should be seeing the same thing in our lives that we see over and over again in his. Counterintuitive discoveries in our picture of God as revealed by a deepening devotion to Christ. Transformation from the old way of thinking, which says we've already figured out the truth, to a new way of thinking that says it's God's prerogative and seems to be God's very nature to surprise, to upend, to defy expectations. Transformation from a notion of a Jesus that bends and conforms to our preferred way of doing things and thinking to one which bends and conforms us to his. And Peter's life, and in particular this story, whatever it is, miracle or metaphor, is telling us that no matter who we are, we still have a lot to learn about Jesus, and the best and perhaps the only way to learn it is as the divine presence of God settling on the Mount of Transfiguration like a bright and dazzling cloud told Peter, listen. Listen to him.
Hope you enjoyed and learned something in this message on the life of Peter from South Main Baptist Church. And whenever you're gone this summer, wherever the season takes you, be sure to check back here for your messages. We hope to see you soon at 4100 Main Street.